the deaths are among a series of seemingly avoidable killings across the United States. Over the past 5 years, a New York Times investigation found police officers have killed more than 400 drivers or passengers who were not wielding a gun or a knife or under pursuit from a violent crime, a rate of more than one a week. Most of the police officers did so with impunity. Only five have been convicted of crimes in those killings, according to a review of the publicly reported cases. Yet local governments paid at least $125 million to resolve about 40 wrongful death lawsuits and other claims. Many stops began with common traffic violations like broken taillights or running a red light. Relative to the population, black drivers were overrepresented among those killed. The recurrence of such cases and the rarity of convictions both follow from an overstatement, ingrained in court precedents and police culture, of the danger that vehicle stops pose to police officers. Claiming a sense of mortal peril, whether genuine in the moment or only asserted later, has often shielded police officers from accountability for using deadly force. "We get into what I would call anticipatory killings," said Sim Gill, the district attorney for Salt Lake County in Utah. "We can't give carte blanche to that." In case after case, police officers say they had feared for their lives. And in case after case, prosecutors declared the killings of unarmed motorists legally justifiable. But the New York Times reviewed video and audio recordings, prosecutor statements and court documents, finding patterns of questionable police conduct that went beyond recent high-profile deaths of unarmed drivers. Evidence often contradicted the accounts of law enforcement officers. Dozens of encounters appear to turn on what criminologists describe as officer-created jeopardy. Police officers regularly and unnecessarily place themselves in danger by standing in front of fleeing vehicles or reaching inside car windows, then fired their weapons in what they later said was self-defense. Frequently, police officers also appear to exaggerate the threat that they face. In many cases, local police officers, state troopers or sheriff's deputies responded with outsized aggression to disrespect or disobedience. A driver talking back, revving up an engine or refusing to get out of a car. What police officers sometimes refer to as contempt of cop. In dashboard and body camera footage, officers could be seen shooting at cars driving away or threatening deadly force in their first words to motorists, or surrounding sleeping drivers with a ring of gun barrels, then shooting them when, startled awake, they tried to take off. More than three-quarters of the unarmed motorists were killed whilst attempting to flee. "We have got to take him out," an Oklahoma state trooper declared over the radio in 2019 to patrolmen chasing a man in McAllister suspected of shoplifting. The police officers used their cars to force his SUV from the road, opened the door as it rolled slowly past, and shot from both sides, killing the driver, dashcam footage shows. A Tennessee sheriff ordered his deputies to fire at a motorist with a suspended license in 2017. "Don't ram him, shoot him," he later recounted saying, according to a body camera recording. "Knocking a man off the highway might tear my cars up." Struggling to subdue a driver, a few months later, a patrolman in Mound Ridge, Kansas, warned that the man might be reaching for a police sidearm. An officer shot him, another struck his head with the butt of a shotgun, and a third pummeled his body with a baton, killing him, though he never touched a gun, video records show. And last year, a body camera recorded a police officer in Las Cruces, New Mexico, warning a motorist that he would choke you out, bro, then pinning him in a headlock. A good little scrap, the police officer called it, before realizing that the man had died. Some families of the driver said that their relatives were not blameless. "I don't have my head buried in the sand," said Deborah Lilly, whose 29-year-old son, Tyler Hayes, had drugs in his car and tried to run away when he was pulled over for tinted windows last year by a sheriff's deputy in Hamilton County, Tennessee. "I'm just saying he did not deserve to get shot in the back." Over the next 3 months, the deputy shot at two other unarmed drivers, wounding one. Almost all of the police officers involved in these cases declined to comment or could not be reached. Advocates for the police argue that the dangers of stopping cars require readiness to use deadly force. "I have watched enough videos of a police officer who is not on edge enough, and his dashcam films his own death," says Larry James, General Counsel of the National Fraternal Order of Police. "What are you going to do? Are you going to be indicted or are you going to be buried?" Traffic stops are by far the most common police encounters with civilians, and police officers have reason to be wary in their approach. They don't know who is inside a car or whether there are weapons. 10 police officers have been killed this year in such interactions, including a Chicago police officer who was shot in August by a passenger during a traffic stop for an expired registration. But some police chiefs and criminologists say that alarmist training about vehicle stops has made police officers too quick to shoot at times, resulting in needless killings of civilians. Academies and commanding officers often rely on misleading statistics, gory cop-killing videos, and simulated worst-case scenarios to instill hypervigilance. Many police officers are trained to place a hand on the trunk of a car as they approach it, to leave fingerprints as evidence if ambushed by the driver. "All you've heard are horror stories about what could happen," said Sarah Mooney, assistant police chief in West Palm Beach. "It is hard. It is very difficult to try to train that out of somebody." The overemphasis on danger has fostered tolerance for police misconduct at vehicle stops, some have argued. Prosecutors and courts give more leeway to police officers' decisions to use force at vehicle stops as a result of the exaggerated concern about the potential for police officers getting hurt, said Michael Giannaco, a consultant to police departments on officer accountability and a former Justice Department prosecutor. He added, "Officers would likely kill fewer drivers if there were deterrence." Some police officers involved in fatalities at vehicle stops cite their training, which for decades has stressed the perils of those interactions. In many departments, police academy lessons and daily briefings include a steady diet of body-worn camera videos that depict easygoing police officers being gunned down by drivers. Seemingly, every police officer in America has watched the 1998 dashcam footage of Deputy Kyle Dinkheller's murder on the Georgia roadside, where he pulled over a veteran with a semi-automatic rifle in his pickup. Trainers and tactical guides typically emphasize that the vehicle stops account for more killings of police officers than almost any other type of interaction. Of the roughly 280 police officers killed on duty since the late 2016, about 60 died, mostly by gunfire, at the hands of motorists who had been pulled over, a New York Times analysis showed. About 170 other police officers died in accidents on the job. But the assertions about the heightened danger ignore the context. Vehicle stops far outnumber every other kind of police dealings with civilians. In fact, because the police pull over so many cars and trucks, tens of millions each year, a police officer's chances of being killed at any vehicle stop are less than 1 in 3.6 million, excluding accidents. Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. Or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام می‌گذاره، همه این ارزش‌ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام: من طلب شيئا ناله أو بعضه.
Ali said, "One who is in search of something will obtain it, at least a part of it." Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the programs to my brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. We find in this book called Tadhkirat al-Huffaz by Sibt ibn Jawzi, where he has this passage talking about Imam Ali alayhi salam. It is interesting, but you know, in this modern day, we seem to be stuck in this cycle of materialism and consumerism. We seem to be stuck in these waves of this great ocean of desires and wants and needs, which at times can never be fulfilled, and yet we still decide to pursue these things as if they were the purpose of our lives. So we find here that Imam Ali, he says that, "O people, break the stormy waves of mischief. Take the illusionary crown of honor off of your head. Abandon the path of discord and walk on the path of happiness." Dear friends, it has been written that the parable of the world is like a fatal poison drunk by an unconscious man. And truly, as we hear the words of Imam Ali, he tells us to break the stormy waves of mischief. Mischief and creating problems and creating issues among society, of course, causing a detriment to the individual as well as to the society in general. And sometimes we forget that we should be humble, we should have humility in our lives, in our actions, and in our behaviors. And so Imam Ali, he says that we should take the illusionary crown of honor off of our heads. Arrogance comes about, dear friends, when we put this makeshift illusionary crown of honor upon our heads. Arrogance comes about when we consider ourselves to be better than others. And finally, Imam Ali says that to abandon the path of discord and to walk on the path of happiness, this is truly success. The path of discord only causes chaos and harm and detriment, while walking on the path of happiness, contentment, and satisfaction with what we have results in our success. Another great lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
تبقى عيني بدمع مشتاقيا قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبي ولها ولا راغي
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی
human in general whether a muslim non-muslim or even a disbeliever respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib. This means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
When we look at the concept of vilayat, which has different meanings and dimension, it means the leadership of Ali and Ali Ali. It means the sense of love that we have towards Ali and Ali Ali. So all different meanings of vilayat come in when we use the term vilayat. And the importance of this can be explained in many, many words and, you know, articles and books. But since I'm talking to Shias, I think the best thing would be to go to the words of the Ma'sumin themselves, beginning with the hadith from the sixth Imam, Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salatu wasalam, where he talks about the importance of the vilayat of Ali and the Imams who came after him. And this is a hadith which is reliable, acceptable by the Shia ulama, and it's narrated by Zurara, a very famous companion of the Imam. There are actually four or five of them who are known to be the pillars of the teachings of the sixth Imam. If it hadn't been because of them, you know, the ahadith of the Imams would have been lost. And Zurara says, one day The sixth Imam talked about this concept of the five pillars of Islam. And you must have heard this term many times before. You know, especially the majority Muslims, the Sunni Muslims, also talk about this concept of five pillars. And when we are talking about five pillars, we are not talking about usul al-deen. That's a different thing. An Imam also talks about five pillars, but there is difference in one item in the Sunni version of the narration and the Shia version of the narration. The Imam says, "Bunya al-Islam ala khamsa Shia." Islam is based on five things: ala salat, wa zakat, wal hajj, wa sawm, wal wilaya. Islam is based on five things. One is namaz. The second is the issue of zakat. Number third is hajj. Number fourth is the fasting of the month of Ramadan. And number fifth is wilaya. In the Sunni version of the narration, it says ash-shahada, you know, the kalamatain, the shahadatain. But in the Shia ahadith, everywhere you will see any imam who talks about the five pillars, he talks about namaz and roza and zakat and hajj, and then he talks about wilaya. And so Zurara basically asked him a question when he heard this. He says, فَأَيُّ ذَلِكَ عَفُوَلُ. Out of these five pillars of Islam, which is the most important one? Which is the most afdal? An Imam says, الْوِلَايَةُ أَفْضَلُهُنَّ لِأَنَّهَا مِفْتَاحُهُنَّ وَالْوَالِي هُوَ الدَّلِيلَ عَلَيْهِمْ. Imam says that out of these five pillars of Islam, wilayat is the most important one, because this is the key to the other pillars of faith. And the holder of the wilayat, the imam, is the one who will teach you how to do the correct namaz, how to do the correct roza, how to pay the correct zakat, and how to do the correct hajj. So all the four actually depend on the wilayat and guidance of the imam ma'soom. And therefore, wilayat is the most important of all five pillars of Islam.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
In the limelight.
In Britain, the Environment Agency estimates that 5.2 million homes and businesses in England are at risk of flooding, and that about 700 properties are vulnerable to coastal erosion over the next 20 years. We're prepared for you an article written jointly by Helen Pidd and Joe Sandler-Clark. The piece is titled Revealed, A Third of England's Vital Flood Defences Are in Private Hands. Investigation has found a third of England's most important flood defences are in private hands, with more than 1,000 found to be in a poor state and some at risk of complete performance failure. Private owners cannot be forced to make upgrades to the defences, which can involve bills of hundreds of thousands of pounds. The British government admits it can only encourage third-party owners to do maintenance, though the Environment Agency can carry out emergency repairs if there is a risk to people, property or the environment, and try to bill the freeholders afterwards. Data obtained under Freedom of Information laws by Unearthed, the investigative arm of Greenpeace UK, and shared with The Guardian, shows that privately owned assets classed as high consequence are twice as likely to be in a poor condition as those maintained by the Environment Agency, with 8% or 1,109 of private defences rated as subpar. The flood defences range from flood walls or embankments to weirs and piers, though many are outfall pipes or culverts, enclosed watercourses that run underneath roads, railways or other property. Some are owned by major landowners such as Crown State or Network Rail. Others run under private houses and businesses, often unnoticed until something goes wrong. In 2014, a father and son in Waterlooville, Hampshire, were faced with a £150,000 bill to repair a culvert that went underneath their properties. According to the Environment Agency, high-consequence flood defences are the most important because they contribute to managing flood risk in a location where the consequence on people and property of an asset failing is high. Defences are inspected and then rated from condition 1 to 5, with 1 meaning good. 4 means poor, with defects that would significantly reduce the performance of the asset. And 5 means very poor, or severe defects resulting in complete performance failure. There is no public record of who owns or maintains private flood defences in England, and local authorities are often unaware. To build a partial picture of private ownership, Unearthed took Environment Agency data and overlaid it with data from the Land Registry and other sources. Kirklees Council in West Yorkshire, which dealt with bad flooding during Storm Ciara in 2020, said it did not know who owned the 23 privately owned defences in its area that were rated as poor or very poor. The local authority in Carlisle, which has seen repeated flooding in recent years, said the same about the 30 poorly rated private defences in the city. Even when local authorities do know the owners, they cannot compel them to carry out repairs. James Mead, a flood and water manager at Sheffield City Council, who said he contacted private owners by looking on Google Maps and cross-referencing with Environment Agency data, noted, "All we can do is ask nicely." Some 29 defences rated poor or very poor across England are on land owned by the Crown State, the Queen's property manager. A spokesman said, "The Crown State did not own the defences, nor did it have responsibility for their upkeep, but did not respond when asked who was responsible." The spokesperson said, "Where flood defences have been installed by third parties on Crown State land, we will always work with the relevant authorities to offer any assistance we can to ensure they are able to access and maintain as required." The Last year, the National Audit Office, the NAO, said the Environment Agency's plan to beef up England's flood defences was being undermined by a lack of coordination between the various bodies tasked with maintaining them. With increased flooding, one of the greatest risks facing the United Kingdom as a result of the climate crisis, this year the government announced £5.2 billion to build 2,000 new flood and coastal risk management schemes. Private defence owners will not be eligible to receive any of this money. The Environment Agency estimates that 5.2 million homes and businesses in England are at risk of flooding, and that about 700 properties are vulnerable to coastal erosion over the next 20 years. An Environment Agency spokesperson said, "We routinely inspect both Environment Agency and third-party flood assets. Repairs are prioritised where there is threat to lives and livelihoods. We work closely with third-party asset owners to encourage them to undertake repairs." The spokesperson for the Environment Agency added, "Since 2015, more than 300,000 homes have been better protected from flooding on time and on budget. We've also made preparations for the winter months, with thousands of frontline staff ready to respond to a flooding incident should it occur." Olivia Blake, the Shadow Flooding Minister, said the government must do more to make sure private defences are up to scratch. She said, "As our winters get wetter, the climate emergency will put flood defences under greater strain." She added, "The government must act to ensure there are clear responsibilities and adequate measures in place so that any flood defences which are privately owned and critically important to the protection of the public are properly inspected and properly maintained."
علي حبه جنة وسيم النار والجنة وسي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Wassalatu wassalamu ala sayyidina Muhammadin wa ala ahli baytihi at-tayyibin at-tahirin. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the topic of the Charter of Islamic Governance based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahj al-Balagha. We are trying to understand what Imam Ali alayhi salam's view on Islamic civilization and the Islamic social structure and Islamic political structure is. And we are trying to understand that through the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in the sermons that he has given during his lifetime. One of those sermons is the sermon number 87, where Imam Ali alayhi salam explains about the situation of the communities before the coming of Islam. And this discussion is important. Why? because when we understand how the situation before Islam was, then only we can appreciate what Islam did to those communities and what changes it created towards the goodness of the society. And then only we can compare our situation today and see what is needed and what the communities are thirsty of, and you will realize that that is Islam. Imam Ali alayhi salam, in explaining what communities were facing on those days, says, وَالدُّنْيَا كَاسِفَةٌ نُورٌ. In those days before the coming of Islam, the world was shadowed from light. That means light was not there. Darkness had engulfed it.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, Imam Ali alayhi salam says that وَالدُّنْيَا كَاسِفَةٌ نُورٌ, that the world was shadowed from the light. There was a barrier that was not allowing the light to reach the world. As if the light had set, had gone away. It was not there, it was not present because of the amount of barriers that were there in front of it. Was engulfed in darkness. What does this mean? What does this mean that there was no light? كَاسِفَةٌ نُور مُطْلَقًا. That means indefinitely, rather unconditionally. There was no light there, absolutely. There was no light. Why was there no light? And what is meant by there not being light? And how can there be no light when the biggest societies, the biggest empires in the world existed at that time? The Persian Empire, the Roman Empire, with all the glamour that they had, were existing at that time. And yet Imam Ali alayhi salam says, وَالدُّنْيَا كَاسِفَةٌ نُورٌ, that the world was eclipsed from the light. The world had no light. What does that mean? This is what Imam Ali alayhi salam is trying to drive in. There's a beautiful point, a subtle infusion of truth that Imam Ali alayhi salam wants to keep and place into the hearts and minds of the people. That light, that loftiness, that enlightenment is not in these material manifestations, in this apparent glamour. It is not there. There can be something that is completely glamorous in the internal, in the external sense, in the apparent sense, but it can be at that very moment experiencing its darkest moments, experiencing the darkest levels of its existence. It is possible. And don't be surprised, therefore, when the leaders of the Shiite communities and the leaders of the Muslim world say that the arrogant powers of the world, like of course America, like these other countries, like Israel, they are experiencing darkness. It is completely true. They are dark. Yes, they might be glamorous. They might be shining with all those skyscrapers, but they are in darkness. And I will explain to you, inshallah, what this darkness is.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Now, what is this darkness that Imam Ali alayhi salam is talking about? That these apparently glamorous realms and countries and cities and you know places are within darkness. What does that mean? That is the darkness of imaginary success, the darkness of imaginary development and progress. You can see that those realms, those worlds, those areas that are right now progressing in terms of industrialization, progressing in terms of their infrastructure, progressing in terms of their material progress, in terms of that apparent glamour, in terms of the technological establishments. But those same communities, when you look at their people inside them, those flowers of humanity are withering in the cold and dark atmosphere of confusion and farness from the divine infusions of God's light, because of them being far from the teachings of Islam. You can see that they are going towards a state of depression. Look at the youth of the American population. Just, if you take an example of America today, look at the youth. Just look at the statistics. I don't like to quote statistics all the time, but if you look at the statistics, look at the amount of drug abuse. Search drug abuse in America, drug abuse in the Western world, the amount of alcoholism, the amount of people that are suffering from depression and stress and all these psychological disorders. You will find that at the top levels will be these countries that are so-called the developed world, that is glittering with the glamour of apparent beauty and material progress. That means that they have not really experienced true progress. Inshallah, we will see and we will discuss about the meaning of true progress with time. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معناه باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمناه هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي رباه.
Iranian Radio Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line. The group was formed to address major issues related to global economy. It is composed of world's largest economies, including Brazil, Britain, China, Germany, India, and the US, among others. These member countries account for 80% of the global GDP, 75% of global trade, and 60% of the world population. But the G20 has been criticized for its limited membership, particularly for its underrepresentation of African countries. There are also disputes over the legitimacy of the G20 and criticisms of its organization and its declarations. The group has failed to address its previous promises, like inequality, social justice, poverty, capitalism, and unemployment. Therefore, the summits are often met with protests, especially by anti-globalization groups. This year, the G20 annual summit gathered the international leaders of world's biggest economies for a two-day meeting under the chairmanship of Italy in Rome. The summit was the first in-person meeting in over a year after the 2020 summit was virtual due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Still, Chinese President Xi Jinping and Russian President Vladimir Putin participated in the summit virtually. The member states addressed several global challenges, such as the pandemic, climate change, spiking energy prices, supply chain disruptions, and so forth. The bloc is under pressure to make headway on tackling global warming. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres warned G20 leaders to show more action to overcome mistrust to advance climate goals. These nations account for roughly 80% of the global greenhouse gas emissions. This year's event comes amid protests at inaction to address the problem of climate change. On Friday, thousands of school students staged a rally calling on the G20 summit to deal with the crisis. Other groups, including the charity Oxfam, also held a flash mob in Rome. They demanded world leaders end global inequality of access to coronavirus vaccines and treatment. In fact, wealthy nations such as the US have implemented a Me First policy by stockpiling vaccine doses and offering booster shots, while many poor countries are still waiting to receive their first COVID jabs.
Well, they have failed to end inequality, to end poverty, and to slow and change the trajectory of climate change, because the leaders of these governments simply don't care about those things.
After Washington imposed fresh sanctions against Iran, the United States and the European signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal have urged Iran to return to the talks soon to avoid what they call a dangerous escalation. In a joint statement following the G20 summit, US President Joe Biden, German Chancellor Angela Merkel, French President Emmanuel Macron, and British Prime Minister Boris Johnson have called on Iran to, quote, change course. That's a reference to Iran's remedial moves on its nuclear commitments. Tehran stood by its obligations for a whole year, but started cutting back on them in response to the US abandonment of the deal in 2018 and the failure of the European parties to keep their side of the agreement. Iran says it's ready to restart negotiations in late November, but wants to see the verifiable removal of sanctions as an outcome of the talks. Washington, on the other hand, targeted Tehran's drone program with a new set of sanctions on Friday, a move which Iran says is at odds with the White House claims of wishing to rejoin the agreement.
They will justify it by saying that Iran wouldn't come back to the bargaining table. They will not look at the fact that it was the United States that withdrew, and the United States that must make the first major moves to resurrect this agreement. But this summit is certainly a place where many, many discussions occur, many issues are on the table to be resolved. The situation with U.S. violation of the JCPOA is certainly one of them, but it is being ignored.
Iran has been under the most intense scrutiny and inspection by the IAEA than any country in the world. Meanwhile, Tehran has time and again stated that its nuclear program is peaceful, and it was among the first nations to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Tehran's stance is clear: effective removal of anti-Iran sanctions and the normalization of economic and trade ties with the country. Iran requires guarantees that the other parties to the 2015 nuclear deal will not break their promises once again.
Sudan's transition to democracy has been disrupted by yet another coup. Last week, head of Sudan's ruling council, Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, announced a dissolution of the country's transitional government and declared a state of emergency. He cited political infighting for the decision, adding that the move was made to avoid a civil war. The military rounded up Sudan's top officials, including Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok.
This government, or this government that Burhan has overthrown, was a government that came about on the basis of an agreement that there would not be any elections, that there would not be a democratic transition. It's important to stress that when al-Bashir fell, the reason why the civilian parties were happy to enter into an agreement with the army is because they felt that if they went to elections, the Sudanese people would reject them and vote for Islamic-leaning parties, i.e. vote for the Islamists in a different form from al-Bashir. And therefore, these leftist parties that are the civilian parties that Burhan has overthrown, they were happy to prevent elections. They were happy to take 67% of parliament unelected. They were happy to agree to an extended transition period in order to avoid giving people a say in what they wanted.
Nearly a dozen protesters were killed in the demonstrations that ensued, but that didn't deter the Sudanese from calling for mass protests against the coup. General Burhan has expressed hope that a new prime minister would be chosen to form a government within a week. He also suggested that the ousted prime minister has been offered a chance to return to his position and select a new cabinet. The next government is expected to stay in power until an election in 2023. The protesters say the military isn't serious about handing over power to civilians, describing the council as an extension of the old regime. The coup in Sudan drew condemnation from the international community, with the United Nations Security Council adopting a unanimous declaration calling on the junta to restore the civilian government. The World Bank has halted financial aid to the African country, while the African Union suspended Sudan's membership in the bloc. Iran has also denounced the coup, saying the undemocratic removal of a part of the ruling system in the African country disregards the demands of the Sudanese people. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh raised the possibility of foreign interference in what led to the ouster of Sudan's civilian rulers. He referred to reactions from Israel, where he said some are openly expressing delight in the aftermath of the recent coup. That doesn't come as a surprise, as Sudan normalized ties with the regime last year under an agreement brokered by the administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump. Sudan's top brass have also maintained good relationships with the United Arab Emirates, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia, but experts believe that seemingly close ties might not last long.
It's important to remember that the UAE are also allies with the leftist parties in Sudan. The UAE was part of brokering the agreement between the leftist parties and the army, and also the UAE is hesitant with regards to the army that Abdel Fattah Burhan leads, in that even if it is perhaps comfortable with Abdel Fattah Burhan, the army is still seen to be predominantly Islamist, the army is still seen to be predominantly conservative, the army is still predominantly against normalization of ties with Israel. Even if Abdel Fattah Burhan himself has been pushing normalization of ties with Israel, there is a worry in the UAE and in Egypt that if the army becomes stronger in Sudan once more, then Abdel Fattah Burhan will not last long, and it may well be that they go back to the more conservative trends that al-Bashir represented. And this